Driving to my parents' house is like the quick grey stormwater overflowing out of an open sewer. Usually make the decision the night before. Leave my share house with its dog shit filled backyard. Before I go, I sit on Bunnings outdoor furniture with the bobble-headed twink I share with. I ask him if he's got the HIV yet, and who's on the meth yet. He cups his milk neck with a palm, his hair flops over his eyes, and I tell him everything will be okay. I'm thinking while looking at him, idiot, don't listen to me, I don't know shit. M5 Drive is my arterial between Western Sydney and the up-and-coming Belmore. But to me, it's already old and gone. On Canterbury Road, I'm two minds, devils versus angels. Tell myself something comical about the folks. I'll laugh at and with them. But the other side of me is just so over cute. So I puff another fine cut wide, but then I'm on Burwood Road. Cafes hosting players from the Sydney Bulldogs. Pure muscle hulks pose for camera phones with plus size preteen woglets. I pass a leagues club with its fake rock three-tiered waterfall that spews flames hourly at night, attracting those high roller Asian gamblers. A new smoothie bar has just opened. Glamours in Lorna Jane, full face of makeup, living the dream and working off excess pregnancy weight between cigarettes. This is when I hit the street my parents live on. Neat front yards, bottle brushes on nature strips. Down a long driveway is my parents' single brick shack. I pull up to our yard and my baba, my one bit dad, is up on a ladder near the macadamia tree with a mini chainsaw that hollers. Smoke all around him. Pretty soon my mum comes to the front door wearing a robe and slippers. The first thing she says, "Never lets him grow, he ruins all the trees." She gestures with the mug in her hand. Nescafe flies around her. You can see all the trees aren't as big as they should be. Seem strangled, sort of. The fig tree has missing limbs. The citrus tree's too straight with only three or four refined branches. He sees me in my car, climbs down the ladder, takes off protective goggles. "Hello, young man. What are you doing here? Is the boy coming?" Mum approaches the car. "Do you want me to cook you something?" I tell myself to hold on, to show up pretty soon. I answer all their questions with one-word answers. But my parents still want something from me. I'm a man who isn't there. Yeah, they put down plates of food, we eat together. But really, I'm not there. I'm just their son, and in their head, they are singing old songs, and my mum is all burned up because her dad died that morning. Baba exits. Me and her are steamed up. Her body is all tense at the limbs, body of Frankenmama. Her eyebrows furrow, they meet in the middle, they arch and squiggle. The bottom part of her face doesn't move. Her lips and mouth carved by Phidias himself. "Who told you that he died?" I ask her. "Thiatula called me from Greece today, but I knew last night." Her big bum and crooked knees, my mum moves around the kitchen like an obstacle course. Poor thing has to hold the green vinyl chairs at the table to get around them. She goes behind the white laminate benchtops and opens the cupboard and stove. She pulls out a box filled with incense relics. Lights incense in the thurible. Turns off the radio every time I turn it on. "No music for 40 days, we are Greek and we are mourning," she looks at me cross. She throws all the meats out of the fridge, pours fresh milk down the sink. "We are fasting for 40 days, we are Greek and we are mourning," she looks at me angry. She gets a can of oil, oranges, sugar, flour and baking soda to make death biscuits. As she squeezes juice out of the oranges, she tells me about how my papu, her baba, yelled her name last night out while she slept. She bites her lip while kneading. "That's when I knew he died." Tears drip down her chin, falling into the dough. She keeps rolling the death biscuit dough, her tears mashing up into the yellow lump. my eyes cast away from her. I remember my teenage visits to the mountain village every winter. Me and Mama stayed in the two-bedroom hut she was born in. My job was to roll Papu's cigarette, light them and put him in his mouth. He was bedridden and would call for me from the other room. One time he spoke Katharevusa to me, and he said, "I am an old lion, and this lion's time has passed." It sounded much grander at the time. Outside of the kitchen, I hear my dad start the chainsaw again. My mum stops her crying and kneading. She goes to the kitchen door. "No work for 40 days, you idiot. We are Greek and we are mourning," she screams. For the 40th day, I wear my monkey suit to church. Old ladies I've known since I was a puppy asking me about marriage. My mouth swells with no answer. Mama intercedes, saving me. "You're supposed to light candles for each person you worry about. Kiss the icons as you place candles into a sandpit." I light one candle for myself. We walk home from Agibandi. I try to figure some of the houses. Corinthian columns replaced by the colour torp. Rose bushes, now Australian grasses. A silver hybrid pulls up in front of a torp house. A woman in her 40s wearing compression tights gets out of the car. She has a ponytail. Mama says a neighbourly hello. The woman smiles tightly back at us. Her face shows no emotion. Perhaps can't even recognise that we are human. "Koloxeni," Mum hisses. New people that live in Belmore, they get me for it. Old people that used to live in Belmore got me ages ago. Mama mourned mild madness. 40 days go by okay, pray candle philoxenia fasting. Music came back with fresh milk bottles. I hightailed it out of there when the doggies won the semi-final. That night, I refilled my overnight bag to a chorus of beeping car horns. Couldn't get out of the suburb. Main road shut it down with revving gridlock. Human bodies accessorized with short hair, crew cuts and too tight fitting muscle tees. Bulging biceps. Heaving on drums. Cigarettes without plain packaging. P-platers, wogs, lebs, islanders, older men with families, turning the main street of Belmore into a blue and white Mardi Gras.
No one talks about you. Their wounds still roar and weeping. I know next to nothing about you. Your name is rarely mentioned. Every story starting with, "One time your mother." As though you were merely a plot device to further my own pain, and not a protagonist in your own right. Maybe your name is the salt to their wounds. They need that distance to answer a curious child's questions without spiralling into a depressive state. A lot of your old friends will only speak your name while three bourbons deep, eyes glazed over and memories buried in 1988. All stories I know have been retold to the point that I know them off by heart. All light-hearted romps that end with something broken and the storyteller distraught. I wonder about you. I wish I could ask you, what's your favourite colour? Is it green like mine? What's your favourite book? Mine is Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I'd read it aloud and pretend you were reading it to me when I found a nice quiet spot to hide from the rest of the world. My Wonderland was a world filled, not with nonsense, but filled with love and attention from my family, alive and dead. What's your favourite movie? Captain America, I'm sure you'd enjoy it too. Everyone is pretty and everything hurts. Did you prefer coffee or tea? Tea always. I have chamomile and vanilla, cranberry and pomegranate, blackcurrant, Darjeeling, cranberry green tea, Irish breakfast, English breakfast, and Earl Grey. Little Gran was a serious tea peddler. Did you ever cut your hair out of boredom? I have pictures of you with cropped blonde hair like Princess Diana. The resemblance made me distraught when she passed away. It was like losing you all over again. How do you feel about organized religion? Would you have sent me to Catholic school? Did you like Coca-Cola, passion fruit donuts, and cheese on everything as well? I've seen that photo of me at 2.5 with a 1.25 litre tucked under my arm, but I'll blame your little brother for my caffeine addiction. Are you cool with me being bisexual? Would this have caused arguments? Would you have been the sort of mum to tell me I was wrong? Honestly, I don't think you'd care, but some of our family are still Catholic. Would you be one of those Facebook mums that send everyone game requests and comment on other people's photos of me? That's fine, could totally deal with that. Just stay away from my Tumblr. Who is my father? Do I even want to know? Would you have supported me during my terrible emo phase? Please, God, no. I hope you would have smacked me and told me how dumb I looked with short hair and a chin-length fringe. What were your ambitions for me? I doubt Penniless Ryder was at the top of the list. Did you prefer cats or dogs? Thanks for buying me a kitten when we lived in Ambervale. I've adored cats ever since, even if the one I have now is the worst but super adorable. Was it okay for people to lie to me about your death? I understand not wanting to explain an overdose to a kid, but using the words, "we'll tell you when you're old enough," really not cool. I believed your death was so violent they would have never told me. Like something from an R-rated film. Something involving violence and fear. I'm sorry how relieved I was when I found out the truth. I know you'll never be able to answer these questions. But I was raised by Disney films and can't squash that tiny ray of hope that one day all my questions will be answered and my father will appear and will live happily ever after in a big magical castle.
Everyone underestimated my mother. Everyone. Phoebe Carroll was her name. A thin black girl with hair piled high on her head. Disposed of from the Cootamundra girls' home in 1928 to middle-class Mossman. From the house on the hill to the house on the harbour. A new life she was to make for herself. In the white world, without identity or culture. A teenage apprentice. Keeping house for other people. Sitting kids for other people. A Cinderella for other people. A black Cinderella for other people. Come 20 years old, this Cinderella was a ball of style. A supermodel. From a generation stolen, but still not forgotten, to a woman hell-bent on proving all wrong. The bells of the past no longer deciding who comes first and who second. The girl from Cootamundra passes through those gates at the bottom of the hill and proved everyone wrong.
The day you died, there was traffic. Lots of traffic. By the time I got to the hospital, your bed was empty. I met my wife at a social function held by the company that we both worked for in, Dulwich Hill. Could have been Earlwood. She'd been married before and had a daughter to that marriage. We started going out together and enjoyed each other's company. Finally, one day, we decided that we should become engaged and marry. We celebrated that day's decision by hopping on a train, then a ferry to Manly, and had fish and chips for lunch. Her family was supportive, and when we did marry and had a daughter, her mum said to her that she should stop work and devote her time to bringing up our daughter. I had no objection, but it created challenges and meant a tight budget unless I made major changes to my work situation. So, 7 years of study later, new job, new direction, new motivation, new opportunities and challenges. Everything was going well. Then our situation changed. A few years before she died, it became apparent that my wife was ill, as she had some difficulty breathing. This was ultimately diagnosed as emphysema, and she was treated for this with the usual puffer medications. Her illness caused her to become frustrated and angry. It also resulted in a couple of trips to hospital by ambulance to recover. She didn't want her family or friends to know how ill she was. I started to share her illness. There were nights that I couldn't sleep, couldn't breathe, couldn't bear to be in the dark, and had to go out of the room and turn a light on. Despite her illness, she displayed great courage and determination. We had very few differences of opinion. However, one of our differences was where to live. You see, we lived in Bankstown, but she came from Monterey on Botany Bay, where she'd been living with her parents. Bankstown was different. For one thing, it was 24 kilometres further inland, which meant it was hotter. She hated the heat. Through the course of our marriage, I made several offers to move to the Warrinora River, to a riverside home, which back then was available at an affordable price. However, my offers were rejected as moving from one old home to another. But my overriding concern was that her health was deteriorating. Why move when the future was so uncertain? A dilemma that I found unable to discuss, or indeed resolve with her. A few months before she died, we were out shopping. She asked me to call in to our doctor to obtain a prescription for some more of her medicines. We were lucky enough to find parking outside the surgery. The doctor asked me to sit down. In that moment, I found out that she had 6 months to live, at most. I was devastated. Does she know this? No. Can I talk to her family, especially her first daughter, about this? No. Who can I tell? No one. My darling,
The day you died, there was traffic. Lots of traffic. By the time I got to the hospital, your bed was empty. When I got back home around noon, if ever I were to believe in God and angels, it was at that moment when I had what I can only describe as a spiritual experience. I heard what sounded like the whooshing of an angel's wings as it came down to gather your soul from me and take you to heaven. A few nights later, I had a dream. You were walking away from me with other people. You turned around, looked at me and said, "Are you coming?" "Not yet," I replied. "I'm sorry I couldn't get to the hospital in time to say goodbye. You're a good wife. Could put a cooked meal on the table when I was still scratching my head, wondering what to eat. You had a sharp mind. Everything was black or white, no shades of grey. You left a legacy of two wonderful daughters and a whole lot of good memories. We loved you then. We miss you still. And most of all, I apologize that we could not agree on where to live."
I had a job writing wills for a while. It's hard to keep descendants out of your will. The court assumes that if you left them out, it was probably a mistake. So if your kid challenges it, they'll likely get something. You have to explicitly state, "I give nothing to my son." And then you have to say why. I only found that out after Grandma had been dead for 4 years. I was curious at the time, but now I'm kind of glad I never saw her will. Grandma's house wasn't anything special. Single story, red brick with a kumquat tree out front. She used to have this giant fold-out couch that let us touch the ceiling when we stood on it. And there was a big golden retriever named Honey in the yard next door. The best thing, though, was that the library was just across the road. A lot of the time, Grandma's house was more about books, porcelain figurines, and smashing bagfuls of macadamias open with a hammer than it was about Grandma. Grandma was just in the vicinity. I feel that makes at least one of us a bad person. I used to wish I was as thin as her, but I like food too much. Before I was born, she went through a time when she didn't eat enough, and something went wrong with her stomach, so she had to have part of her digestive tract removed. And after that, she made her papaya the size of spring rolls and only ever had two at the most. I eat at least two, and they're more the size of doner kebabs. I can't imagine she ever had a big appetite, though. Grandma had Meals on Wheels delivered, but she didn't always eat them. While we were clearing out her house, I had lunch from one of the trays we found stacked in her freezer. Her house never smelt of food. It smelt like Enid Blyton books, mothballs, lavender and potpourri. Even when she baked with us, it was always plain white scones, the tap water of baking. Once my little sister secretly pushed a maraschino cherry to the centre of a scone and we watched it emerge as they baked, pushed to the top like a popped pimple. Grandma thought it was silly. She didn't find it as funny as we did. We didn't even like maraschino cherries, really. We only ate them because she gave them to us. Grandma wasn't really a grandparent, not like the ones in the books. We spent so much time at her place, but now all I remember are other people's anecdotes, and the way her hand felt like a bag of twigs while she was alive, and a cold fish when she wasn't.
Grandma was the worst for hugs, like a wooden hat stand wrapped in a cardigan. It felt less like being hugged than hugging. I know I used to tell her all about my day and my friends and whatever we were learning in class, but I can barely remember Grandma speaking to me. The only conversation I can recall having with her was in her kitchen when I was around 9 or 10. Mum had dropped us off after school and before she finished work, and I had just gotten my Japanese test back. 48 out of 50. Good, but also disappointing. I don't know where my sisters were, but I was playing with the ugly pig magnets on Grandma's second fridge when I noticed the round ceramic doll on top of it. A fat white figurine with big black eyes and hiragana on its belly. I couldn't reach it without climbing on the counter, which wasn't allowed, but I pointed at it and said, "That's Japanese. I can read that." Grandma was making herself some tea by the sink, but she stopped to come over and stare at the doll as well. She asked me, "What does it say?" So I sounded out the characters. I don't remember what any of them are now, except for "no," which looks like a tadpole chasing its tail. Grandma nodded, not taking her eyes off its belly. Then she asked me what it meant, but I couldn't tell her because all I'd learnt so far was how to introduce myself and say apple. She told me she also knew some Japanese, that she had to learn in school. Then she went back to her tea, leaving me staring at the incomprehensible writing for a moment before wandering off to find my sisters. I could reach the top of the fridge by the time she died, but the doll wasn't there anymore. Even if I had found it, I don't know what I would have done with it. Taking it would have felt like stealing. Never mind that she was dead and nobody else cared. The last thing I said to Grandma was, "I love you." Well, that's not true. The last thing I said to her was, "Grandma?" Because I wasn't sure if she was still there, if she could hear me. I doubt it would have made much difference. I remember her knitting us blankets once, and she gave us a pet rabbit and Cadbury choc chip ice cream. So she probably loved us, but it was hard to tell.
I got home very late. I was the kind of tired that screams for sleep from deep inside the muscles and bones. I pulled the covers from the bed, took my coat off and let it drop to the floor. My mobile rang. It was you. The line was like one of my migraines, dark blotches, wiping out words. I tried to make sense of what you were saying. Your voice refined and mellow BBC was asking more of me than the sentences you uttered. The call dropped out completely. You phoned again. The line still wasn't clear, but we spoke about our daughters. You said, "I can't wait to see our granddaughter." I laughed. "Well, they'll be there with you next week. Not long to wait. She's so gorgeous. Reminds me of Lorato at the same age." The line dropped out. You phoned again, and the line dropped out. You phoned again, and I didn't answer because I wanted to sleep. 4 days later, you died. Our daughters were on the flight to Joburg. If I could answer that last call, would I say, "I love you"? The ultimate cliche. A text message with a less than symbol and a number 3. A sing-song, "Love ya," standing in for bye. I met you after rain. That sweet, sultry night, we squashed into the back of Olpa's car. My thigh soft against your thigh, heading for a party in Moshudi. Michael Jackson's falsetto, "Don't stop till you get enough," blasting from the speakers behind our heads. Swarms of heavy-bodied ants flew into the headlights. Your shirt unbuttoned at the chest, gold chain, tight flares, aviator glasses, big smile and rumbling laugh. Lighting a spliff. The smell was you in the morning, you in the evening. Smoke curling up in front of your face, floating with the music. Donna Summers, Earth, Wind and Fire, Mannenberg taking a stand against apartheid, Abdallah Ibrahim playing piano, Basil Kotze on tenor sax. The woman on the record cover wearing a duk, kids standing behind her, unaware that they would become an icon like the song. Dollar taught you karate at school. The Afro arrived in Africa. Black consciousness, PAC, ANC cadre were crossing the border. We danced in friends' homes, tightly packed into dark community halls, on flat boulders by the dam. We danced when I was carrying our first child. We danced in Sarowe, Lobatse, and Mole Polole, and in Soweto with Nyaka Nyaka, thinking we could ignore Slegs Blancas and Slegs Vierne Blancas, eating fat cook and greasy Russians with chips. We pulled over in some dorpie to buy a drink. Maybe it was Swartruggen's. You walked into the Springbok Cafe through the whites only door. There was no sign. The Afrikaner's vrouw with bleached blonde hair told you to go out and come back through the other entrance. Same counter. Same Afrikaner woman serving. You didn't buy drinks. And the music played. Yvonne Shaka Shaka, Brenda Fassi, Sipo Hotstick Mabuse, Hugh Masekela recording strains of Umbakanga in the bush. Our second child was born at night. You didn't make it to the hospital until the morning. You kept dancing. I was at home. Sometimes I went with you to football matches when Not Wani played, and to Bruce Lee films, and to weddings and funerals. The funerals became more frequent than the weddings. Friends died in car crashes and of whispered illnesses. The South African commandos bombed our neighbours. Pieces of their bodies hung in the syringa trees. You were out drinking that night too. You missed the kids' birthday parties. Coming home late, drinking, smoking. Murmurs of one-night stands. You cried when your mother died and we hugged each other. Then I left you. Ra lorato oni abina piri. You danced the hyena. Your daughters, Bana Binapiri. They dance the hyena too, and so does your granddaughter. It's in their blood. I flew to Habarone. I viewed your body in the coffin. Your face thin. Your skin the colour of stormy twilight. I walked through the red-brown dust to the grave. Voices rose in harmony, singing hymns without accompaniment. Dumelangiatsamaya kea. let patching la. Farewell, farewell, I'm leaving. I'm going to that country. I stood with family. Your family of aunts and uncles, sisters, father, nieces, nephews, cousins, and friends. Like the mysterious way music embodies emotion, resonant within time. You are a part of me. If I could answer that last phone call, I would say, thank you, Ralorato, Keagorata. Yes, I would say that kind of gravely sunburnt I love you that grows from passion and respect, like scars on old wounds. Robala ka kahiso. Rest in peace.